Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00047. Recorded on May 22, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Raritan 4. Raritan 4. Chapter 47.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
And now, from the small world category, I've been thinking about making a very quiet, under the radar return to the fellowship halls of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why? Only to make myself available on the front lines of problems in our society to be of assistance, right? There's something fulfilling about that if done in the appropriate manner. What do I mean by that? My history is dictated throughout all these, really, literally decades, right? Difficulty in that particular environment. That particular environment is, by definition, loaded with mental health issues, right? Issues. AA, known for their 12 steps, right? The 12-step program of recovery has in it, in the second step, say right up in front, you know, right up in front, right in your face, talks about the necessity to be restored from insanity, right? Insanity. It is the expectation for people who are new in recovery to be insane. And then there be some variance of graduation away from that insanity over time. But no one's to say that anybody is ever fully de-insanitized, right? In fact, 35 years later, can be regarded as insane to some degree, I'm sure. not like it was in 1988, not like it was at all. But anyway, I'm thinking about going back into AA, and I took a ride out on a motorcycle over the weekend just to kind of run the fluids and kick up the electricals and everything. And I did a little drive-by by a location where there's the potential for a new AA home group for me to join in. I've not been to this meeting before, and it just seems like their time slots and general locale to my home sort of kind of adds up. So I think I'm going to kick the tires on that should I ever get off my ass and actually go. It'll be a weeknight sort of thing, and maybe one night this week I'll take a a ride up there and check it out, see if it's for me or not. But anyway, you know, with that on my mind, right, I talk about the small world category. You know, once upon a time, here in Texas, I met a guy at an AA meeting, and we were friendly for a while. I've lost touch with him because I haven't gone to AA on a routine basis in 6 years now, right? I think in 6 years, I've gone to 3 AA meetings, you know, 3, that's it. And, yeah, I kind of lost touch with this dude. But I met this one guy meeting years ago, years like 10, 11, 12 years ago. And it turned out, right, it turned out that we did the math and we put calendars together, and one thing led to another. And we were able to realize that we were in the Marine Corps at the same time. And for a minute there, we were actually in the same place at the same time. In Camp Pendleton, right? Camp Pendleton in California, they have a section for the School of Infantry. Now, I don't know how things have changed over the years. This, again, going back to the 80s. But they had a School of Infantry there, a couple of buildings for that. And then across a parade deck, which is basically a parking lot where you don't park cars. It's where drilling, marching, exercises occur, you know, and a presentation for graduation ceremonies and shit like that. Outside, kind of parking lot-ish parade deck, right? So on the north side of the parade deck, you had the School of Infantry barracks buildings. And on the south side of it, you had the MCRD, Marine Corps Recruit Depot, field exercise facilities, right? And San Diego, California is one of the two United States Marine Corps recruit depots. It's the West Coast one. The East Coast one is Parris Island, South Carolina. And that's where I went, being from New Jersey at the time. But then I got sent to the infantry school over in California for whatever reason, instead of North Carolina. Like, which would be typical, but there I was over in California, and while I was there in the infantry school, across the parade deck was Marine Corps recruits out of San Diego, and in and amongst those people at the same fucking time was this buddy of mine that I met in a AA meeting here in Texas, right? So a small world, right? As you end up basically having right there on that parade deck, at the same time, two problem drinkers who would eventually get their shit together to one degree or another, you know, put the drinking behind and get on with life. And, of course, he returned to his faith, which was Roman Catholicism, and I found faith in Christianity. In the days where I knew him, it was my Protestant days, and of course, anybody who listens along here episode to episode knows that I've converted into Holy Orthodoxy, Eastern Orthodoxy. Anyway, yeah, two problem drinkers at Camp Pendleton on the same fucking parade deck, right? And how much smaller you want the world to get? Let me shrink it down for you a little bit even more. Anybody here within range of listening, do you remember a guy named John Wayne Bobbitt, right? John Wayne Bobbitt. John Wayne Bobbitt came to prominence as a national figure here in the United States of America back in the early 90s, right? Back in the grunge years, as I refer to so frequently. And no, he wasn't exactly a grunge musician per se. Although somewhere along the way, he did try to form a band, as the story goes. But no, he got famous for... How do you say this in proper societal terms? Let me just read to you Wikipedia information, right? And you just determine for yourself what the fuck is going on here. John Wayne Bobbitt, born, like me, in 1967, and Lorena Bobbitt, his wife at the time, born somewhere thereafter. They were an American couple married on June 18, 1989, whose relationship received international press coverage in 1993, the grunge era, when Lorena severed John's penis with a food knife which I read further was actually a Ginsu, the old Ginsu commercials, a Japanese Ginsu knife, while he was asleep in bed. The penis was successfully surgically reattached. Lorena, an Ecuadorian immigrant and the primary breadwinner, claimed that her husband John, a bar bouncer and former U.S. Marine, had raped and abused her for years. John was charged with rape later that year, but was acquitted and subsequently starred in two pornographic films. The next year, Lorena was acquitted of assault by reason of insanity and went on to start a foundation for domestic abuse victims and their children. The couple divorced in 1995. About the attack, the incident in which Lorena Bobbitt severed her husband John Wayne Bobbitt's penis occurred on June 23, 1993 in Manassas, Virginia. Lorena stated in a court hearing that after coming home that evening, her husband had raped her. After he then went to sleep, she got out of bed and went to the kitchen for a drink of water. She then grabbed an 8-inch Ginsu carving knife on the kitchen counter, returned to the bedroom, pulled back the bed sheets, and cut off his penis. After this, Lorena left the apartment with the severed appendage and drove away in her car. After a length of time driving and struggling to steer with one hand, she threw the penis out the window into a roadside field. She eventually stopped and called 911, telling them what had happened and where the penis can be found. John's penis was found after an exhaustive search. Imagine being on that search party, right? Fucking A. John's penis was found after an exhaustive search, and after being washed with antiseptic and packed in saline ice, it was reattached in a hospital where he was treated. The operation took 9.5 hours. John went on to star in two pornographic films in the 1990s and stated in 2018 that his penis is back to normal. John also went on to accumulate a record of serious abuse allegations and some criminal convictions. All right, so that's the basic gist and the background of the whole thing. So raise your hand if you remember that dude, right? You remember that dude, John Wayne Bobbitt. So now we'll go back into that parade deck at Camp Pendleton. Now, I was in the school infantry, and this AA buddy of mine was over in the recruit depot section, either on their 2 weeks of rifle range qualification, training and qualification, or the week or two, I forget how long it was, of field operations, right, that we get in the basic training in the Marine Corps, right? Well, meanwhile, in my training platoon, the corporal in my training platoon, one of the trainers, like the assistant trainer in my platoon, right? We had an E6 staff sergeant who was the trainer guy. And that was his day job, his 9-to-5, training us infantrymen, or us grunts, in the ways of Marine Corps infantry. And his assistant was an E4 corporal. Well, that dude was John Wayne Bobbitt, right? Small world, isn't it? A small world. So John Bobbitt was actually in my platoon, the assistant trainer of my infantry school platoon. And, you know, apparently, as you read his story further, this is not me imposing my inferences. I actually read specifically that a lot of the accusations, the allegations, and actual convictions that was mentioned in the article I just read almost invariably involved problem drinking. The guy shows, like, the history of problem drinking and abuse with it. In fact, I could say so much as what I remember of him personally. And you've got to imagine the whole, like, sense of no fucking way I had when this news broke on a, like it said, international level. No fucking way. I knew the guy, right? What I remember of him does not resemble what had become of him. It doesn't resemble drunkenness, alcohol abuse. It doesn't resemble abusiveness in general. It doesn't resemble a gregarious, boisterous, personality. It doesn't resemble a sudden irrational temper. Any of the things that would go with this kind of really peculiar sequence of domestic issues that this guy seems to have had in his life, you know, it was not readily visible. He was a quiet kind of dude, you know. He was in a secondary role as a trainer, basically learning it, and you know, he remained to himself, and he did what he was called on to do by his boss, who was the staff sergeant. And I never thought poorly of him at all. In fact, I thought he was kind of cool. You know, he was kind of cool. He had a decent demeanor and a laid-back temperament, right? So I'm sure that he wasn't drinking on the job. And he probably had something of a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde thing going on where the alcohol was concerned, right? Which is typical amongst problem drinkers. Just add a little alcohol and you get instant asshole, right? As the saying goes. But yeah, so we had two problem drinkers and then apparently a third one too. So that was in Camp Pendleton, right? San Onofre or Onofre, or I don't know how the fuck you say it. We got a couple of California people at the church who has their way of saying it. I forget what was proper. We all just called it Onofre when we were there. There's a section at the very northwestern corner of the Camp Pendleton, which is a very large base, down in Southern California by San Diego. And, you know, the main road through that section, right? Here's another kind of small world thing, I guess you could say. The main road through there, and really, if not the main road through the entire camp, one of the main roads through the camp for sure. It ran from there at that northwest corner all the way down to the southern end of the base, where it met its end at another main road that was like the gateway road. The southern gate main entrance was on this one particular road, the name of the road I'm talking about here is Bassalone Road, right? It ran north and south across the entire length of the base, meandering through the hills and the mountains, the desert, everything out there. And now most of the people out there, you know, unless they were really studied up on their World War II Marine Corps history, which for some people that was a likelihood, but for most, no, they wouldn't know. I knew right away. Who the fuck is Bassalone? I knew who that was. Why? Because Bassalone was John Bassalone. He was a Medal of Honor winner. In fact, he might have been a two-time Medal of Honor winner. He's a badass World War II dude. And he was from my neck of the woods back in Jersey, right? He was from a town called Raritan, New Jersey, Raritan Borough, which was part of my school district, right? I came from the village of Martinsville in the township of Bridgewater, and the school district I went to was Bridgewater Raritan School District, right? So Raritan was a part of my school district. The next town over, right? In the schools, in middle school and shit, when I was a little kid, I played on a basketball team, a sports team. We would go down into Raritan to play against the kids from Raritan in the Little League, in the baseball. I remember, you know, we would have our tournament teams, our all-star teams would go out to tournaments, and we would practice. We would have, like, little scrub games against the Raritan team. We always kicked the living shit out of them. I don't know why. Raritan's a small town. In New Jersey, it's what's known as a borough, right? A borough is basically a town without a township, by definition. In New Jersey, like Massachusetts, you have, in Pennsylvania, you have townships. And what that is having towns that kind of link together and share resources, such as police force, for example, or first aid, rescue, and things like that, fire departments, right? You have shared commodity across towns, so it's like a network of towns linked together, and they would call that a township system. But then you would have these odd towns that don't want to be part of a township, and they would be referred to as a borough, right? And they're common down the Raritan Valley train line. You go down that line, you had a lot of boroughs that weren't part of townships. But to me, you know, if I had to describe it to you plainly, they are very small cities, right? I lived in one, three towns over from Raritan as a young adult growing up, called Bound Brook, right? Bound Brook is a borough. Wasn't part of any township. It was right on that Raritan Valley train line. It was 1 mile square. That's the size of it. That's how small these towns in New Jersey can be. They could be smaller than that even still, but just 1 mile square. And in that 1 mile square, you had like a downtown area that took up almost half the town, with the train running through it and all this commerce, you know, kind of tall buildings, you know, apartments on top of retail, shops, theaters and restaurants and whatever. And right out your front door, you're on it's a little city, right? So Raritan's one of those also. It's the same kind of design. And in Raritan, Raritan, New Jersey, I guess it's the southern, perhaps western end, pretty a western end, or southwestern end. There's a statue that's been there forever. And the statue is John Bassalone, Marine Corps hero. He's got in his hand some kind of full automatic weapon, you know, like belt-fed ammo. You know, he looks really badass, and that was a badass dude who did majorly heroic shit to earn the highest military honors, right? Congressional Medal of Honor. So I knew a little bit about John Bassalone, and when I landed out there in Camp Pendleton and I saw that name, I knew what that name was referring to, right? So Bassalone Road running through Camp Pendleton, John Bassalone coming from Raritan, New Jersey, and my stomping grounds where I grew up. And, you know, even in my adult life, I wasn't like I just played sports against some of the kids from Raritan. I had a couple of girlfriends that lived there when I was an adult. Neither of those relationships went good. It's part of my AA problem, right? I'll dial that back again. A lot of the problem in my life, you know, big solution in my life was AA. Big problem in my life was also AA. Why? The insanity I was talking about. You spend time around a certain element of people, they become your society, right? And when your society is filled up with lunacy, you will tend to have dramatic conditions in your life. I was meeting at least 50% of the girlfriends that I dated through to my adulthood at AA meetings. Those relationships invariably were loaded, like Ron White would say, right? Loaded. With all kinds of difficulties and drama, dramatics. They always difficult relationships. And there are two girlfriends that just jumped to mind from Raritan that I recall from those days. And there may have been more, I don't know, but both of them were AA relationships. One of them was absolute bedlam and insanity. It required me to get restraining orders against this person and everything, right? I left that one without saying goodbye. I ran for the fucking hills and left no popcorn trail, no breadcrumbs behind me, you know? I just moved out of the area to get away with it and didn't even say goodbye. The other one, as it happened, and I didn't do anything particularly mean or nasty, but as I drove away in my pickup truck, after I dropped her off after a date, she was throwing bricks at me as I drove away. And I'm not going to sit here and say I don't know why. I know why. It was a girl who, frankly, after spending an evening with her out on a date, I put two and two together and decided that no matter how attractive she may be, our concerns and personalities, they don't jive. And I've pretty much just told her flat out, look, you're just not my kind of person. Not mean she was a bad person, but woo, she didn't like that. And yeah, it kind of got ugly really quick, and I sped off in my pickup truck. She did not hit the truck, but I saw those bricks coming, you know, shatter out in the street behind me. Anyway, that's more than all y'all need to know. But I mean, Raritan was a part of my life, you know. I got to throw in another for instance, you know. I was still on the drugs and drinking. I was still going to school, maybe my first year out of school. I hung around with a bunch of people down the Fin Dern section of Bridgewater. We did a lot of house partying down there. And, you know, the slow moment, like on Sundays, we took to watching New York Giants football games, right? They started around 84, 85 to start to get good. And even though we were burnouts and shit, we would just sit down with, you know, a case of beer, smoke weed, eat pizza and shit, watch football. We did, you know, we started getting into it. And then eventually in 1986, the Giants would win the Super Bowl and all that. So on those Sundays, what we would do, instead of just like going down to the local pizzeria and getting ordinary pizza, and there was always good pizza to be had anywhere you went in that part of New Jersey, the northern part of the state, we would go over to Raritan and we would get these calzones at a place named DeLucia's, right? DeLucia's Pizzeria. Holy fuck. They made like their own, like a flat calzone on a really big tray. It was a huge thing, but it wasn't like the little football-shaped calzones that you would get, right? And then we would do this like every Sunday during football season. We'd get a bunch of beers and we would get these calzones from DeLucia's in Raritan. It was a ritual that we did. And fucking A, they were good. They were really good, the best around. I believe that that place is still in operation, but I'm not positive. I'm very, very far removed from it. I mean, but that was part of my existence back then, too. And when I started to decide to make my own, like, homemade Newark-style hot dogs, right? The Newark, as I called it, the Newark Italian hot dogs, you had to get a special bread. It was called pizza loaf, and nobody had it like for retail purchase generally, but there was a store, a bakery in Raritan, right? Raritan was in a very Italian town back then. There was a store, like I said, a bakery, an Italian bakery in Raritan that would make that shit for you on order, right? I can't remember the name of it. But you could order it in advance, and they would make you a sack of them, and you come pick them up a few days later or whatever like this. I did that a couple of times. That was as authentic as I could get with the Newark-style hot dogs, as they are. That's a couple of examples in Raritan anyway. Raritan, my niece, it turns out, I've been talking with my mother recently, my brother recently. My brother's daughter, my niece, she works, I think, in Somerset County, which is where Raritan Borough is. Somerset County, some like administration, something to do with law enforcement or just law in general. Her profession up to this point has had something to do with, something in proximity to police and detectives. And I don't know exactly what it is, but she's had success, a very successful person up to this point in her young life. But now she's making a move. She decided that she wants to become a detective herself. And to become a detective, she actually has to go through the police academy and serve as a patrol woman, right? A cop on the beat, on the force for some amount of time. Before she can apply to become a detective. And guess what? She's going to a police academy and she's going to work in Raritan. Raritan. All these connections coming back. And it doesn't stop there. It doesn't end there. See, Raritan, and it's like over the weekend, right? Talk about my weekend where I rode off on the bike and I did a drive-by by this potential AA home group facility. And I had a couple of things to do this weekend. They were kind of leftovers. They were on my my put-off list. The things I didn't get to during the week, I could have. I could have, and I decided not to. I would just handle it on Saturday. I handled all this stuff on Saturday. And when I got done doing what had to be done and getting caught up, I kind of took the rest of the weekend off. I just had that tired, done feeling about me, and I just wanted to plunk down and relax, eat well, you know, and that's that. That's what I did for like 75% of the weekend, as it turned out. It was like almost like I took a sick day from the world. And I wasn't sick or anything, but I'm very well rested, thankfully. It worked out okay. What I was doing during that restful period of time, I was watching Star Trek Picard, right? That's the new, one of the two new Star Treks that are out there. They're now starting to release the fourth and final season of it. I had tried it back in the fall, and it didn't catch with me. I watched maybe four or five episodes of it, and for some reason, it just wasn't sticking. I don't know if I was not focused in on it or whatever. I left it with the feeling that it was just kind of slow and stodgy and not getting to the point. And I don't know how I got that feeling, because I decided just to watch it again for the hell. But there's a reason. The reason I went to watch it again is somewhere along the way, the cast and crew appear on a planet called Raritan 4. Seriously, Raritan 4. Who the fuck ever heard of Raritan outside of people from New Jersey, right? I'm talking about Raritan Borough. There's also a Raritan Township that Raritan Borough is not a part of. There's the Raritan River, North Branch and South Branch. They kind of meet together somewhere around Raritan Borough, and they ride east out to the Raritan Bay through New Brunswick, like I mentioned. They go out like Perth Amboy to the Raritan Bay. The mouth of the river opens up there. You end up in the bay. But all this Raritan stuff is New Jersey stuff. And like I've traveled this whole country. I've never seen that word or heard that word out of anybody's mouth pop up anywhere that's very local to that vicinity. I don't know where it comes from or what the etymology of it is. Probably should have looked that up, but I did not. And that's always out there to do when I have a curious moment and time to piss away as such. But who the fuck ever heard of that word? But here it is being used as the name of a planet in this Star Trek iteration, right? For lack of a better word, Star Trek iteration called Star Trek Picard. It's actually called Raritan 4, right? Which implies that there's a Raritan 1, 2, 3, possibly others. But Raritan 4 is a planet that they... And it turned out, right? This was the impetus for me to watch again because I missed that or I didn't get to it. And I thought that was a curiosity. I heard it or read it somewhere. Kind of incidentally. I had no idea. It turned out, as I recall, that there was somebody who was involved with the production staff of the this television series who comes from Raritan, New Jersey, right? Just like John Bassalone. So again, here's that small world effect. So anyway, I decide to watch Star Trek Picard, and I'm scratching my head trying to figure out why I disliked it the first go around. It's actually exceptionally well done and a really cool story, and it's actually quite a bit fast-paced. It's almost hard to keep up with. I don't know how I had the impression that it was opposite of all of those things the first go through, but I like it. I like it. It's pretty cool. So I got into the very beginning of the second season, and I think it was the first episode of the second season where Raritan 4, the planet, occurred in an episode. So I saw it, right? I got there. I think it's a one-off. I don't think that's going to be significant to the ongoing story. I don't know how many seasons this Picard thing is. I think it's 4. I think like they're releasing the fourth and final season now. But I don't know. It might be 2, 3, 4. We'll see. You know, I'm also waiting for Strange New Worlds to come out with its new season. That's the one that I really liked. It was the prequel to the original series. the sequel to the Star Trek Enterprise. It's the kind of wedged in between those two time sequences. But that was the one I thought was best of all. But they only had one season out. So I'm kind of up to speed with that. Imagine that. Me. I'm always behind schedule. But when it comes to Star Trek, suddenly I'm on time for at least a couple of things. All the rest of it I'm brand new to. And I'm, you know, fucking A, 35 years behind schedule last fall. But whatever. You know, Star Trek and Star Trek Picard. And I spent the weekend doing the proverbial binge watching, and it was literally binge. I was eating and watching and napping and waking up and watching more and eating more, and it was just a cycle, you know. Very restful. Again, very worth the bother. I've got to do that sort of I usually do some semblance on that a Sunday, but Sunday it's usually like a half a day of that after church. We didn't even go to church. I just wasn't feeling anything in me to get up and do anything and take part in humanity at all for some reason. I really don't even know what it was. I just must have been ground down to some level of deep inner fatigue that wasn't even registering in the forefront of my mind. I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, and I shouldn't even try to, but I ended up binge watching, you know, science fiction. And yeah, there's an element of me, obviously, that goes in for science fiction, as conservative as I probably would appear to most anybody listening to me. You know, conservative culturally, conservative morally, conservative fiscally, pretty much would add up to conservative politically. And what do I mean by conservative? That is maintaining an anchor to tradition, to things that are tried and true, right? As opposed to that which would be progressive, which is all about opening up a whole brand new future and trying all kinds of new things, right? That is what all society is made out of. An inclination to both past and future from your place in the present, right? And just because I am so obviously conservative, so obviously traditional on so many different levels, it does not mean that I don't have an appreciation for the optimism of humanity that comes with the development of new ways and new methods, right? It's just I'm a little stodgy when it comes to giving myself over to such things. I will hold on to what is tried and true and then try to incorporate newness into that. That is a conservative approach, an open-minded conservative approach to things, and that's how I would regard myself, right? So in that mix, obviously, I've got that little aspect of myself that is progressive, that does desire new things, that does look to a future with optimism, which has regard for invention and innovation, which has a heart for improving problems in society in general. I have that quote-unquote inner progressive inside of me in spite of my traditional values, right? And, you know, there's obviously, like where innovation and invention come in, the idea of improving things in general, there's a lot of goodness, right? There's a lot of goodness. But again, my progressive inclination is very much tempered with morality and responsibility and maturity. You know, I retain my maverick quality of independence, where on the other hand, the people in this modern era anyway, the modern form of progressivism, and it may also be in prior forms of it, I don't know, I haven't thought it through, but definitely what we're looking at right now, differently than any semblance of a maverick independent spirit, you've got this like hive mind mentality going on. People who are with the progressive leaning, with their arms wide open to the future, seem to have no anchorage linking back to tradition and past. They seem to have cut ties and jettisoned the whole fucking thing in exchange for whatever may lay behind door number two. And somehow they have all been corralled, to use a maverick cowboy cattleman term, herded into this hive mentality, where whatever the leader of the pack determines, the rest all just kind of naturally go along with it. They would call it a hive mind, a herd mentality. And like, these things are not bad in terms of collectively teaming together to achieve an end, right? We all pulled together as a team, to quote Pink Floyd, "Have a Cigar" from the Wish You Were Here LP, right? If we all pull together as a team, this is the idea. There's a singleness of purpose, which actually quotes AA, going back to AA again, right? With a singleness of purpose, we are trying to help alcoholics to recover and, you know, to achieve sobriety. There is some semblance of this hive mind, or in Star Trek terms, right? Going back to Star Trek, all this shit is linking together, right? In Star Trek terms, you got the Borg, right? The Borg, the enemy of, Star Trek The Next Generation. And again, they start to have the inklings of reappearing in the Star Trek Picard episodes that I saw over the weekend. They're there, they're on the fringe, they're a little bit different, and I don't know what's going to come of it to this point. But they were definitely a huge element in the Star Trek The Next Generation. The Borg, right? And the Borg had the Borg Collective, the big pop culture saying, quote-unquote, resistance is futile. What the Borgs were thousands of cyborg drones, right? They were drawn into this collective hive mind, part of a network, as the collective moved through space and found civilizations. They would basically take them over and assimilate them in, and they would take their creatures and they would turn them into cyborgs, right? They were noted for the ocular implants, right? They put these implants into their face on one of over through one of their eyes, and they would add like bionic arms and different various body parts to turn these beings into supernatural beings in a technological way, right? They're basically transhuman is what we're looking at right here, transhumanism. But I think the important thing to note of them is the fact that these cyborg drones were part of a network collective, and they had a hive mind that actually shared thoughts and information through the network as other cyborgs were out working the process of assimilating newly discovered cultures, right? They weren't making pacts and treaties with cultures that they encountered. They were steamrolling them and incorporating them into their hive mind. They were taking what was good. They were taking the knowledge of the cultures that they were steamrolling, incorporating it into their mentality. And it was a quest for perfection. And I say that, you know, quote unquote perfection, because who's to say what's perfect and what's imperfect, right? It's just an attitude, somebody's definition of perfection in there. And it was all by force. Right? Assimilation, you generally have the idea that you volunteer. Like when I moved to Texas, I assimilated to Texas culture. When immigrants come over from the old world, they assimilate into American culture. But here, as far as the Borg collective is concerned, the assimilation was by force. You encountered the Borg, they were just going to steamroll your entire civilization and take of it what they wanted. And then the taking of it would be what they call, quote-unquote, assimilation. But really what they were doing was taking the information that you had in your mind and bringing that into their hive, to their collective of thinking. Right? Transhuman and violent and mean and ruthless. Like I said, it's an assimilation, but it's assimilation by force. And I think of it in those terms. You know, I think of what we see like now, or what we saw in those weird moments, World War II, you know, the history of World War II, going back to John Bassalone, right? What was going on then? You had these societies, these cultures that were canceling out their political opposition, right? You've seen that in Nazi Germany. You've seen that in communist, Stalinist Soviet Union, USSR, all during World War II, the cancellation of their political opposition. And, you know, you had the concentration camp system, which, of course, my family went through. My father was born in one of them. And then over in the Soviet end of Europe, the eastern end of Europe, you had what they called the gulags, right? Those were Siberian prisons that political opposition would be sent out into. I believe I mentioned about a book I had read maybe a year ago, Orthodox book, a book about an Orthodox priest who was thrown into that gulag system, Father Arseny, and who actually survived it for, I don't know how long, 10 to 20 years. Most people die in 6 months in the horrible condition. He managed to survive it. There was, you know, what seemed to be miracles that were occurring around the presence of this guy. And a fascinating, fascinating story. Real, you know, a true story. A lot of it was notes of witnesses and observers. It wasn't like somebody made up some kind of fictional rendition using the gulag system as a backdrop. But anyway, a little aside from the point, you know, when you got that concentration camp system and the gulag system, these are systems for canceling your political opposition. And the cancellation of political opposition is basically the makings of a quote-unquote utopia, right? What's a utopia? It's that quote-unquote perfect world. Well, what's perfect? Well, it depends on who's defining perfect. Now, we've got, you know, just like you had in Star Trek, you had the Borg Collective. We've got this hive mind now involved with the progressives in our society, or the progressives in society involved in some kind of hive mind thing. It's really weird. It's really weird, and it's really starting to stink of some of the shit that happened in World War II. Waiting in the works to happen again here in the present, right? Because you got this hive mind. It's a utopian oriented thinking. It's people who share a similar outlook for what a perfect world would be like, And that perfect world is always going to be a world that is without their opposition, without detractors, without dissidents. So somehow, some way, they've got to run off or kill off or both people who don't think in the same manner, right? So what kind of perfect world is that? The first thing you are is a killer. And when the opposition is gone, now the collective remainder that theoretically should be on the quote-unquote same page or quote-unquote same team, now you can go and recreate society in your own image without interference. So who are the people doing that now, right? I talked about the progressives before. And it tends to usually be progressives that are doing this. Because why? They don't like tradition. They want out with the old and they want what's new. So it's a recurring theme through history. Somebody, wherever your country is and whatever your traditional leanings are, whatever your traditional structure and anchoring is, whatever your founding documents may be, there's a group of people that are just opposed to all that shit who want to undo it. This is literally an un-American revolution that's going on. It's literally these progressives that are undertaking it, and their strength is this hive mind, this Borg collective mentality, and their optimism for a future that has nothing to do with their opposition, which are patriotic conservatives, Americans. But what are they made out of? Here's the problem. The problem is that these are children of the state, right? You see a lot in the news lately, these past couple of years, where the state, you know, federales, a government, it's probably a better word for it, your government in general, seems to, on the progressive side of politics, have a regard for the children of the nation as a shared commodity. In other words, the children don't belong to the parents, they belong to society as a whole. And by society as a whole, they mean the progressives, specifically, right? But you could debate that. You could debate that either way. But just the basic concept of a children born into this world is owned by the state, not by the family. Of course, any conservative, any traditionalist will throw a fucking fit at the idea of that, and rightfully so, because I'm one of them, and of course I throw that same fit. That's absolutely fucking bullshit. But that's the idea. The idea that they're children of the state, you create this mentality. And it's easy to do when you have a broken family, right? You have a broken family, a single mother running a family, there's no father involved, who becomes the father, right? Vice versa. You got a single father, who becomes the mother? You know, the gap is filled by what? The state, as a means to get through. Now you got a family who's on the government tit. You get kids that are raised in a situation of being on a government tit. That's what looks normal to them in their life. And then when they become adults, they stay on that government tit. And I believe that's the process through generations that has developed this hive mentality. It's a dependency on the state, which is driving the collective. Does that make sense? But it's a whole idea of being on the government tit. And that's what this monster is made out of. And these are people who are bought out by trinkets and baubles, basically. They're sold out to this this collective, this government element, this progressive outlook, you know, exchange for trinkets and baubles. It's like no different than the Native Americans in Manhattan Island got duped by the Dutch that wanted to settle there, who paid them $24 worth of fucking beads and shit for the land that now obviously is some of the most desirable real estate on earth, most expensive place to live in the world. You know, the government has a way of finding desperate situations, if not just finding, I'm actually creating desperate situations where people have to turn to them for assistance. And then they do, well, establish a dependency, like drug addicts, to the additional free money coming in and living a free lifestyle. What you got are these brilliant elitist ruling class of people taking advantage of the weakness in society, of the weak in society, in order to co-opt the power of the nation and then steer the nation to its wicked ends. And I believe it is wicked, and I believe it is an un-American revolution going on, and I believe the power has come in that regard, and I believe it's like with the Borg collective. Yeah, it looks like a collective of information passing on, and it becomes useful and everything. But in the middle of it all, ultimately, there is a Queen Borg, right? There is the Queen, and the Queen ends up being that element, that power that dictates, determines, and drives the entire situation. There is always going to be that quote-unquote queen. There's always going to be that elite ruling class. And this is where people throughout the generations, throughout the centuries, have been hoodwinked, thinking that they're getting all this good stuff, quote-unquote good stuff, and being handed an easy life to live, where what they're really doing is turning over their existence and all the power that they have at hand to protect and defend themselves over to a collective of elitists who forever forward will have the power to do anything they want to anybody they want, including the people that gave them the power in the first place. Evil will turn on its own. Every fucking time. It's just the nature of it. You may have heard me say it before. Look at drugs, how drugs work in a person. Narcotics, I mean to say. You start taking narcotics and it opens up your mind. You see things differently. It feels good. And then after months, maybe a year of that, all of a sudden it doesn't feel the same. It doesn't do anything for you like it used to do. In fact, it's kind of bad. It's kind of negative. Think of like marijuana, right? Simple drug like marijuana. How does that evolve from getting you high to getting you toasted to getting you paranoid? How long does that take? Not long. And even when it doesn't make you paranoid, your whole life is centered around smoking weed. You keep on doing it anyway. This is what happens in these progressive societies, these attempts at utopia. They always fall short. There's always a powerful elite, and an elite that has garnished all power from the rest of the society underneath them, and then holds everybody's feet to the fire. If the economy is not going well for some reason, they'll just go and kill off a chunk of people to not have to care for, like Stalin did with the Ukrainians in the 30s. Holodomor, I mentioned that before multiple times. Big deal in my family, right? We survived that shit. I was talking about my inner progressive, right? I'm bagging on these progressives with the caveat that there is a part of me that has that element, right? On one hand, the progressive is imaginative and inventive, right? And that's a good thing. We're finding new ways, perhaps better ways, to do things in this world, right? But then on the other hand, you've got this lazy and shiftless immaturity that goes with living in a fantasy land, having this imaginary mindset. You live in your imagination with the assistance often of things like marijuana, right? It keeps you apart and away from reality, and we invent our own realities where we live in, and we no longer know how to get along with people. We don't want to be with people. We have nothing to offer, right? And it's really, I think, what this collective is mostly made out of, you know. If you're anything other than that in the progressive collective, you're part of the progressive elite that's taking advantage of the rest of these people. Who's going to enslave them for whatever they're worth? And when it becomes observed that these progressive-oriented people in the hive mind are really worthless because they couch potato and masturbate and eat snack cakes all day. Like I say, you hear me say it all the time, right? This is what I think of a progressive person, you know? This is the other hand. Outside, beyond imagination and innovation and invention and the good stuff that could potentially come with it, is you have a lifestyle of these creatures, of these habits that are on the government tit, that they won't move out of their mother's basement. You know, you've got fucking people who are bringing their childhood into the 30s, avoiding life, not maturing, not growing up, you know. Lazy, immature. Think about it. Like, when you're a kid, right? Because I'm thinking about adults who do this shit. When you're a child, you play games that involve, like, dress up and pretend, right? The old story about the boy and the girl playing doctor and nurse, for one example, right? And you get the girls with the tea set and the imaginary, like, serving tea to, like, queens and kings and whatever the fuck girls do with that shit. It's imagination, and often they'll dress the part for it, if there's a part to dress, right? Being a kid, we played army all the time, like war games, you know. And sometimes kids will take that to an extreme, like getting like a helmet to wear on their head or some kind of military clothes from the Army Navy store, and they'll play army, you know. But whether they dress up for it, they're still going to pretend. They're pretending they're in the army. We were specific when I was a little kid, you know, in the early 70s, and we would play war in the city streets. We were playing World War II, right? That's where I thought, because my father was born in Germany, right? Born in Dachau concentration camp. But because that was in Germany, I thought we were German. So I would always be the Nazi. That was my thing. I'm the Nazi! You know, nobody else wanted to be that. That was the bad guy. I volunteered for it, thinking that we were German. You know, that's how stupid we can be. But nonetheless, it was pretend, right? We were pretend. I was pretending to be a Nazi. And so you got this, like, this childhood. A part of our development is this dressing up and pretending, imitating what adults do, until we come to an age where we do it ourselves for real. Then it's not pretend anymore. And of course, we get all the disillusionment that comes with it. It's not so fantastic to be in the military. And it's less fantastic to be at war while you're in the military, right? These are not good things. You know, these are not great circumstances in so many ways, so many critical ways. But as kids, we dress up and pretend. You know, we had that costume play element. But then you see these adults who are still wrapped up in it, right? And this is what I'm talking about. This inability to really let go of your fantasy lives, to let go of that which is pretend, to walk outside of your imagination and get real. What do you got? You got these people that do like, Renaissance fairs, right? This is not exactly science fiction, but it is a degree of fiction. It's the idea of like medieval times and old English and old Vikings. And then you got the magic and mysticism that goes with that, with all the fucking rune stones. And you know, it gets into all the, like the Celtic fucking occult stuff. And this is the kind of the people. You've got adult people, generally young adult people, but, you know, you go to a Renaissance festival and you'll have guys in their 40s and 50s, and it's really, you know, it's creepy beyond creepy. You know, and they're walking around with their stockings and their fucking fake swords and speaking with an English accent, and it's gayer than gay, right? In my opinion, you know, it's the way I assess it. But, you know, the people that do this shit, and they tend to be you know, like I'm saying, occultists, they're progressives. They live in imagination land, smoking weed. It's all a part of it. It's all a part of it. This is what the hive mentality is composed of, right? In fact, we have in the DFW here in Post Arlen, Texas, because Ward is talking about anything in this monologue without talking about Post Arlen, Texas. South of Dallas in a town called Waxahachie, right? Waxahachie, that's down in Ellis County, I believe. It may be the county seat of Ellis County. I think it's Ellis County. I'm not sure. There's an area where a couple of counties come together over there. Waxahachie, cool little town. We've been through there a few times for odd things. And but they have on the outskirts of it there, the Renaissance Festival. It's called Scarborough Fair, right? That's the DFW, Dallas-Fort Worth area Renaissance Festival. I've never been to it. It's been there for, I don't know, 40 or 50 years every year. It's this time of year too, right? This time of year in May. They run it. And invariably I see ads for it somewhere along the way. And I always get it in my head. You know, that's an easy getaway for half a day. It's not far to go, you know. Go do that shit. It's not overly expensive to get in. And I remember the Renaissance festivals, fairs that I've been to in the past. They are, you know, they would be a lot cooler if I was still smoking pot. Let's just put it that way. I don't think I would like it. But it's a stupid getaway just to go, like, laugh at people. You know, people watch and then giggle and shit. They might have decent food, maybe. Maybe. I don't know. But I went hunting through the website anyway. I got the idea. I mean, it's still going on through this here Memorial Day weekend coming up. There's still a couple of chances to get to go to it. I would take my wife, just one off, just because we haven't done it here. It's something to do. We need to get out and go do something that's different, you know. This would be different. This would be different. I know what we're walking into there. I finally found what I was looking for on the site. At first, I was looking for admission price. It was like $32 for an adult. I guess in this day and age, that's not horrible. I don't know if there's parking on top of it and all that shit. I don't know how it's done. Like I said, I've not been there. But what I need to know is, like, I won't go to places that I can't carry a handgun. I just won't do it. That's a no maverick zone to me, right? And I'm looking. I'm doing, like, searches on the internet, trying to find information from people about whether or not they have firearms restrictions at this place. I couldn't find nothing. But on their own website, finally, after rooting through everything like a fucking hog, there it was. In plain, very plain and modern English. Not only do they have the 30-06 no concealed carry sign, or the 30-07 open carry sign. They even have a 30-05 sign, which I never even heard of, which apparently has something to do with criminal trespassing if you bring a firearm on their site. So it's actually like a third charge they could levy against you. I don't know, whatever. But they seem to be pretty serious about it. You know, concealed carry, you could fuck them off. You can conceal carry because they don't know you're carrying, but something like that, they might run you through metal detectors and shit, you know? And it ain't worth the bother for me. I'm not going to drive out there, you know, 45-minute ride, find where their parking is, pay for that, walk in the fucking sun for a mile, you know, however the layout is, only to have to go through some metal detector device, you know? Now they got the Maverick gun-free zone. Perfect place, you know, if you happen to be one of the variants of mass murderers that we have in this country in this decidedly more and more progressive era of things. What a great place that would be, right? To just go open fire on a defenseless crowd of people. But I won't be there. It won't be me. I won't be there. It's a no Maverick zone. You know, but these Renaissance fair dudes. And of course, I'm describing the image that I have in my head of what progressive people are really like, right? I told you what the good aspects of progressivism are. But then the reality behind that is the people who are this way have these certain common elements to them in general. You know, everything is always going to be in general terms. But this whole, like, immaturity, this this fantasy land, imagination-based existence, you know, on the government tit, with few exceptions, you'll have somebody running their own side hustle, working a job, perhaps. But these side hustles are always going to be involved with things of the imagination and fantasy land, you know, fictional productions like Star Trek. You know, I find value in that, but that is the product of one man's vast imagination. And I know that when you work to create and build upon your creation in fantasy, you live in fantasy. I've spoken about this before, right? When I had found these chapters of a fiction book that I was writing 15 years ago, started to write. While I was doing that, I was caught up in a non-reality existence. I was living in my... And I didn't like it. See, I'm not stoned. I'm not smoking pot. I'm not looking to escape reality. It was very uncomfortable, very disconcerting to me to be doing that kind of creative endeavor that was sticking me in a non-reality while there's an actual reality going on all around me that I was a part of, but I was never seemingly fully a part of. It didn't work, so I shit-canned that project. I don't want to live in a non-reality, you know? For me to do that, when I was able to live in a non-reality, I was on drugs. It's that simple. It's that fucking simple. I have this kind of regard for that kind of mindset, you know. So you got the Renaissance dudes and everything that I would imagine that they're into, smoking pot, doing other kinds of narcotics. But what I was talking about, these little cottage industries that are related to imagination, right? The production of some kind of fiction, a book, a movie, TV, comic books, you know, that kind of stuff. Those are artistic productions of a fictional reality. So somebody who's living in a fantasy land, if they can actually capitalize on their creativity, they can live in that fiction. See what I'm saying? They don't have to step aside from it. They don't have to shatter it with reality. They can live in their little cocoon, in their little bubble. And yeah, and then anything that's like related, I keep on bringing up about drugs, narcotics related. You've got this onset these past few years, the legalization of marijuana in certain states and the legalization of hemp and others. You know, you got the CBD joints that are opening up, right? Those are within the realm of the stoners of imagination land. You know, anything associated with marijuana and narcotics, that they can open up shop, you know. We got like a, you know, you got always got the vape shops and the smoke shops and the little what we used to call head shops and shit. We got one right here down the street. You know, these are things of the progressives, right? Inventing, packaging, and selling, you know, sugary foods. You know, vegan sugary food snacks and cakes and chips and shit like that. Another example of cottage industries, you know, that could keep the fantasy land mindset in their fantasies, you know, without breaking away, because that's what they do. That, you know, this is what they eat, this is how they spend their time. You know, any kind of industry with the involved with the production of games and toys. So you get the video games, board games, whatever kind of games you can imagine. That's somewhere for this mindset, this mentality to enter into. They can imagine in their mind a game. They could live in their imagination. The game becomes something in reality. And if you can capitalize on it, you could remain in your fantasy life, and toys even more so. You know, and now involved with that, I don't mean to be like paint everything completely negative. You're talking about people who have artistic qualities. You have people who have technological qualities, right? The innovation and invention. Nerds tend to be fantasy land people, right? Tech nerds. But when they're involved with their technological productions, they're living in their programming code, and they're living in their little cocoons with like-minded people, hardly ever venturing outside of that realm. I'll use a quote-unquote realm. It's a fantasy land shared. You know, it's a shared fantasy land that creates a society, really, just like the fucking Renaissance fairs at. But anyway, I'm kind of getting all over the map here. There's positive elements to it, like I've described before. And here you've got the artistic aspect, the technological aspect, and then you get into, you know, education. A lot of the, I'm talking about immature people. I'm talking about people that generally don't get along in proper society because they're stuck in a fantasy world. Stuck in a fantasy world keeps you from meeting life on life's terms more often than not. Various ways for various reasons. And what happens is we're very slow to mature, right? The example of the basement dweller, the guy who won't leave his parents' basement, and he's 38 years old and still down there eating Twinkies and smoking pot and jerking off, knuckle fucking, as we say in Post Arlen, Texas, right? Playing video games and watching Star Trek or something, Star Wars probably. It's a little bit less mature than Star Trek. Probably more involved with the Star Wars rendition of things. It's pointed, directed more towards kids, right? Children. This is the whole thing I'm getting into. You know, you got this, these people may find themselves in an educational system. Why? Because you're staying in school, right? A lot of the ways that people extend their childhood is by going to college, getting a bachelor's level degree, getting a master's degree, getting a doctorate degree. They remain in the education system, which is really a place for children. It's a place for students. It's a place for learning and not adulting. Adult things happen, don't get me wrong. But this is about staying away from the workforce and responsibility and extending your childhood, is what I'm trying to say. Into your 30s, you know, into your 30s. What you end up having is a lot of people will stick to the education, the academia, even when they take on work, right? They may learn about computer science, they might learn about rocket science, but they will work as educators because it keeps them in that childhood world. Of imagination land, of fantasy land, where they don't really have to grow up, or not fully anyway. They keep a close proximity to youth while they're trying to maintain youth. And isn't that what the transhumanist quest ultimately is all about? Immortality, right? So this is an element of that. All this shit ties together. I hope what I'm saying is making sense and adding up and kind of cogent, right? What I see with progressive-oriented people is this clash of fantasy world adults with real-world children. And I think more and more in society, more and more in the headlines these days, with communications being at the snap of a finger, we're seeing this clash in action more and more. What we call groomers, right? G-R-O-O-M-E-R-S. It's basically people with gender issues of one sort or another trying to co-opt children from families to incorporate into their own society, into their own hive mentality. to extend and propagate their own cultural proclivities, which will not occur naturally, because when you stick a dick in an ass, you do not get a child. It is a death cult by definition. So the life needs to be stolen from elsewhere. And that's what grooming is ultimately all about. A society that will wane and fade and die in the natural course of things needs to somehow prop itself up. That's what this shit is all about. And the further we get into degeneracy in this nation through time, the more evident these kind of activities become, the more frequently they present themselves. Ultimately, this quest for perfection, right? The quest for perfection, that's what the Borg collective was really all about. The quest for perfection, and perfection always in quotes, because it's a determination by whoever holds the power, right? Whoever holds the power defines what perfect looks like, what good looks like. Ultimately, it ends up being a refusal to mature, which can be translated into a desire for immortality, right? How we define perfection, you know, the people who are weak and taken advantage of, the trinkets and the baubles, like I was talking about, what is quote unquote perfect is more often than not wrongly equated with a life of ease, right? What's good about progressive mentality, invention, innovation, imagination that leads to these things, right? It's a double-edged sword. If we can't break out of our fantasy land, we're problematic. We are taxing culture. We are dragging it the fuck down. But where we're able to morph our imagination into invention and innovation, we come up with something. And so often the things that we come up with are a matter of taking something that we do generally in the course of our mundane living and bring perhaps like an automation to it that creates ease for our life, right? In that direction, we are constantly pursuing a life of ease. And a life of ease does not draw a conclusion of perfection. It does the opposite. It turns you into a fucking lump. The easier things are for me, the more complacent I become. The less enthused I am about things, the less significant I am. And the less significant I am, in all reality, in all truthfulness, is the less significant that I feel. There's no vim, there's no vigor. There's no drive, there's no ambition. There's only rotting away on my couch with my bag of potato chips and my dick in my hand playing a fucking video game. Today, tomorrow, and forever onward. No optimism in that at all. That just sucks. We are completely dependent upon better potato chips, more vile, extreme pornography, more innovative video games, and some way for the government to pay for it all, or for your parents to pay for it all, somebody else to pay for it all. You know, I like to think that we probably already inherited perfection, that we don't have much to seek after. A life with challenges could actually be exactly what we as human beings need. To do what? To fulfill our humanity. We are not only driven to innovation and invention by way of imagination. In fact, imagination isn't even a driving force for it. We use our imagination when we have been driven to use it. And the driving force is necessity. When we need something, we'll find the fucking way to get it. When we think we have everything that we need, we don't do much of anything at all, do we? So, I think our real ambition, and I say this as a Christian, as an Orthodox Christian, I said it before, I'll say it again, I think it's true, I think it holds true, regardless of whatever you believe or wherever you come from. One of the most difficult things to do, for every fucking reason, is to come to the knowledge of Christ. From a Christian perspective, this is what God wants for every single person. Okay, if you are deliberating your faith, your spirituality in any regard, okay, here's your Christian perspective on spirituality. The fundamental thing that God wants for every single person here is for every person to come to the knowledge of Christ. To come to the knowledge of Christ is a real eye-opener. It's a life transforming event. It's huge. And the resistance that people have to it is an expression of the impossibility. It is so unlikely for a person to submit to something spiritual, and yet so easy for them to submit to something tangible. Much easier for a person to relinquish their lives to the promise of baubles and trinkets, to the promise of potato chips and pornography and video games. Things which are terrestrial, things which are tangible, rather than something spiritual that actually works as a basis to define what good is and what right is and fill our existence with real purpose. Contrary to that, right, is the pursuit of humanity, humanism, transhumanism, right? Transhumanistic fantasy is actually an abomination, ultimately, of God's creation. We say that God's creation is not good enough, so we got to use our innovation and imagination to enhance it. And before we even get into cybernetics of it all, which I'm sure are in the works, you've already got things like steroids, for example, right? Performance-enhancing drugs used by athletes. There's a transhuman element to that in all things. But ultimately, what we're doing is we're working against our own nature while we're in pursuit of our immortality. There's irony in there because immortality is freely given to us by this God who wishes for all of us to come to the knowledge of Jesus Christ. Because that's where we get into heaven, a matter of heaven and hell, the afterlife, the afterworld. That's where immortality really is. And we need not take drugs. We need not have any kind of ocular implants. We don't have to live in imagination land and fantasy land and pretend that we're still kids when we're 38 years old. None of that. And all those things don't work anyway. But we submit to them. Why? Because they're tangible, they're terrestrial, and they give us a sense, and a false sense at that, right? It's a sense, but it's a false sense of maintaining our own autonomy. People do not want to submit to Christianity for fear of giving up their moral free agency. But they will submit to the fucking hive mind in a snap in exchange for what? Potato chips? Pornography? Video games? And government-issued marijuana. This is how fucked up we are. This is all about how fucked up we are.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Stalin Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at poststalin.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@poststalin.com.